Campus FM presents a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society, delivered by Adrian Sherry as part of the Malta Historical Society Week. The second talk is by Valentina Lupo.
Okay, welcome back. I hope everybody has enjoyed his tea or coffee and the nice sweets that we had down there. Quite interesting and good. So, we're all strong and waiting for two other papers, two other lectures by our by our guests this year. The first one would be by Adrian Sherry, who is on my right, and the paper he will be presenting is entitled "Of Briefs and Privileges: Two Challenging Cases for the Order of St. John During the 1680s." Adrian,
I'll start by giving a bit of a background to my talk. Military orders were orders of the church, and they were called exempt orders of the church. That means they did not have to pay taxes neither to secular authorities nor to the church. These privileges were acquired in the time of the Crusades, and the property that they had acquired was then exempt. However, the Pope could at times waive off this privilege. This means that, or this meant rather, that every now and then a secular authority would claim the right to impose taxes on property of military orders, or the church itself would like to tax them, as it were. They used to call them impositions rather than taxes, but for want of a better word, I suppose. Well, one instance, for example, that this happened was in Portugal. But before that, was an important privilege that the Order of St. John had acquired with time. And this was that for the Pope to waive off such a privilege, the Order of St. John had to be mentioned by name. And this was an important clause. Such an instant where the waiving off, where there was this exemption, this was the Council of Vienne in 1311, the council that suppressed the Templars. We have the exact words: only the priors, preceptors, masters, persons, and places of the Hospital of St. John of Jerusalem and of the said military orders are to be accepted. You notice that it said the military orders and the Order of St. John. It was clear. The exemption was clear. Another instance where the order was mentioned in a council was in the Council of Basel, Ferrara, Florence, and Rome. This council had moved in every major city, and it was in between 1431 and 1445. The exact words were: "This holy synod therefore imposes on each and every ecclesiastical person, both exempt and non-exempt, under whatever form or words, even the Order of St. John of Jerusalem." Again, there is the mention by name. Military orders, this was not a favor that came out of nothing. Basically, they were military, and the Pope had an interest in the military side, obviously, because of the Ottoman forces. They had to finance their campaigns, and wars are expensive. They were expensive, they still are. A significant percentage of the income of the order, its revenue, came from then its properties in Europe. Anthony Luttrell says, Professor Anthony Luttrell says, that the hospital's retention and enjoyment of these Western properties, incomes, and privileges depended on a second factor: the continued support of popes, princes, and public opinion in general. So the order had to justify these privileges, particularly when the Crusades no longer exist, and the Ottoman threat sometimes seemed far away. In justifying these privileges, it appealed to its twofold mission: the charitable and the military. So in justifying exemption from taxes, from impositions on its territories, the religion, as they call themselves most of the time, appealed to its very nature. And this was the defense of the Christian Republic in the eternal war against the infidel. And this is where the fun starts. 2nd July 1682. Grandmaster Carafa obtains intelligence that the King of Portugal, this is King Pedro II, wants to marry off his daughter yet again. I say yet again because this daughter happened to be Isabel Luisa, whom the Portuguese nicknamed Sempre Noiva, always engaged. Poor girl got never married. She died in 1690 at the age of 21. In 1682, somebody do the maths, but she was pretty young, 13 or something like that. And this engagement was to the Duke of Savoy. Carafa wrote to his ambassador, the ambassador representing the order in Rome at the time, friend of mine, Fra Marcello Sacchetti, whom I worked for some time on his correspondence. And basically, he had some points to say. This is what Carafa had learned, the Grandmaster Carafa, that the King of Portugal had supplicated the Pope to tax church property. That the Pope had conceded to this and exempted by name the Jesuits. That the hospital was not mentioned by name, neither included nor excluded. This was in favor of the order, but still, there was danger. And he asks his ambassador, he asks Marcello, in conformity with privileges, especially obtained by the bull, by Pius IV. So I have mentioned two church documents, the brief that the King of Portugal was trying to obtain. A brief was a document issued by the Pope and subscribed by the Secretary of Briefs. The bull was stronger. It was called bull, in fact, because it was sealed by the leaden ring of the reigning pontiff. And the Grandmaster then charges Marcello Sacchetti to obtain the express exclusion of the order, of the religion. And he mentions a case, the Grandmaster Carafa mentions a previous case, where the King of Poland had tried to tax the order, and something similar had happened. Because the reigning pope at the time had given this exemption again, mentioning the order by name as excluded. He asks his ambassador to say these words, that in service of Christianity, that our revenue, that our income is used in the service of Christianity to defend it from Ottoman power, and the exercise of hospitality. I'm translating the word, actually, it is the infirmary, the charitable side of not just hospitality in the English sense today. He said, as l'esercizio dell'ospitalità, that those were his exact words. Marcello mobilizes his strategy. He first goes to a certain Monsignor Sluzio. I found the name suits him, this person. He was sly, in a way. And he said, I'd like to check the wording of the brief. I went there, he wrote to the Grandmaster, per saper la forma di detto breve, because I want to see this brief. Now, Sluzio answers in a sort of cryptic way. He says, such a brief has not been sent, that he has never heard of the plea of the actual king asking. And if he asked, he said, it would be unjust. And the argument he brought was this, that as long as the princess was not marrying below her status, he said then, the dowry she can take is basically the promise of the kingdom to which she is sworn heiress and nothing else. The money that the king wanted to raise was 1 million crociati. I don't know the exact exchange rate, but 1 million remains 1 million. It is a huge sum, a dowry fit for a princess. This would have satisfied any diplomat, I suppose, that this Monsignor, probably the secretary of the secretary of briefs, but not the ambassador. His tenacity was legendary. He did not take just his word for an answer. So he goes to the congregation of ecclesiastical immunity. Now, this congregation, it was called, was formed in 1626, actually formed for the rightful interpretations of the Council of Trent, Soon it evolved and it became concerned with cases of alleged violation of jurisdiction and ecclesiastical privileges by secular authority. So he was going to the right place, a congregation that takes care of protecting church property. He goes to a certain priest, another Monsignor, he was called Altoviti. Altoviti was secretary of this congregation and a relation of his. Roger mentioned patronage, it was rampant and accepted. And from him he learns that a plea had actually been made, unlike what Slutio had said. But that was about it. No more information. So what does he do? He goes to the congregation of bishops. Goes always one step higher. The congregation of bishops say the plea has been made, but not yet granted. And so, since the religion is not mentioned by name, then its interests are safeguarded. And they added, and he added to the Grand Master, quite proudly, I suppose, that even if that he said the privileges of the religion would be safeguarded, at least due to the moving pleas that I had made in all the three places concerned. This was his style. His actual words, per la vivissima instanza che io ho fatto. He keeps on. He keeps on going to cardinals, adding on, trying to obtain something in writing. Remember, his target was an exemption in writing, written to the King of Portugal. This is what the Grand Master wanted. This is what his ambassador was trying to obtain. He was not hopeful, at least it does not show in his letters, that maybe was either he was probably too conservative, and he wrote, for example, on the 29th of August in 1682, "It would distress me greatly should this brief be issued, for if it is so, I see little hope that the religion would be exempted from paying up once it has been included." The fear was not paying one time. The fear was that any monarch would then quote this incident. And by default, the religion, the order of St. John, would not be included, would not be excluded from impositions anymore. And this was the fear. It was not the one-offs. By the 5th September 1682, he goes to the Secretary of State, certain Cardinal Cibo. He obtains this information that a five-year extension had been granted to the King of Portugal to obtain these, but since money was too hard to obtain, they had changed it to as a taxation on foodstuffs. Still, this was not what he was looking for. And so you go to secretaries, you go to bishops, you go to cardinals, ultimately you have to go to the Pope. And he sends him a letter reminding him that military orders were exempted. He cites the bull by Pius IV that the Grand Master Caraffa had mentioned. He also obtains information about two other popes that had confirmed this bull. These were Innocent X and Clement X. So he's got three bulls against one brief. I mean, it's simple mathematics. He's saying that one brief is not equal to one bull. I have three bulls. And he writes these words to the Pope. Humbly, he adds the adverb. I don't know how much humbly he was. Humbly, we supplicate your holiness to declare that it was not, nor is it his intention, to include the military orders, considering that these privileges were given to them titolo oneroso. I will explain that. That is not only to utilize their possessions, but also shed their blood in defense of the Christian Republic, fighting against the Turk, as De Rota confirms in Decision 72, number 26. What I love about this is the mixture of tone. It's poetic and prosaic at the same time. He takes Grandmaster's arguments, adds some of his own, changes the words from the Ottoman power, which was quite formal, to the Turk, which was informal, yet stronger. He uses the word fighting, but includes the shedding of blood, which is more poetic. Ending, because poems do not convince much, with the quotation of the decision. So the Pope can look it up if he wants to. By 31st October 1682, Marcello could write to the Grand Master that the Pope had written to the Nuncio in Portugal, and had written these very words: "It had never been his intention to include in the said brief the possessions of the religion, and charged his Nuncio to express these sentiments to his prince, to King Pedro II. These were hearsay. He then sends off his secretary to copy the letter, because he could not obtain a copy himself. Sends it to the Grand Master, asks him to put it in the chancellery, in the registry, for future reference. He said, we'll be safe for a long time. That was the end of the Portugal case. However, the very long time was only 1 year. 1 year later, we had the Ottoman power attacking Hungary and the Austro-Hungary, not the Holy Roman Empire. It was a bit of an anachronism there. Thomas Munk says that the whole Habsburg structure was thrown into panic by the major Ottoman attack under Kara Mustafa, which led to the lengthy siege of Vienna itself. Brodel calls it the last great tremor of this great machine. It's 16 October 1683. No letters come to Sacchetti from the Grand Master this time. Noted in his correspondence that by the mid-October, letters from Malta to Rome dwindle. It's the sea. Voyages became much more difficult. Yet he obtains information from the Grand Prior of Bohemia, a certain knight called Fra Kolovrat, if I get the pronunciation right. Again, this is the emperor then applies for a brief to tax church property, to tax even the order of St. John, and this time the brief included a certain clause. The words were, all orders including military, hospitaller, and commanderies. Now, would hospitaller qualify as a naming, an actual naming, or not at all? The prior, obviously this grand prior, high officer in the order, was worried. He asks Sacchetti, he asks the ambassador to obtain, obviously, the exclusion, the usual exclusion that would save the order's property. Save it money, this revenue. Sacchetti immediately wrote to the prior, told him to not to worry, that the order is not mentioned by name, and just tell the nuncio that to suspend any actions whatsoever until this brief is clarified from Rome. And he sounds very positive. But then he writes to the Grand Master, and he's not positive at all. He's extremely worried. He says that I have not received any orders from you, and this is how I'm going to work. The necessity, you must note, the necessity was greater of the emperor than the king of Portugal, who was trying to marry off a daughter, and this one was trying to save the Holy Roman Empire. Again, first step, Monsignor Sluzio, usual. He assures that religion is not clearly mentioned by name, it's hospitaller, could be anyone, blah, blah, you're not included. But he leaves it at that. Next, go to the Secretary of State. And petition him. He does not go once, he goes every week. And he petitions this to tell the nuncio, he said, because he knew that the nuncio would speak to the Secretary of State, and who got there first might obtain what he wanted. And lastly, you go to the Pope. What is that? You can't do much more than that. The Pope is, while he is usually, at least by correspondence, he's usually quite in favor of the order, but this time he was elusive, I would use. He says it had never been his intention to burden the religion where it had not been burdened by his predecessors in similar cases. And that in this last brief to the emperor, he had made use, he says, of the same wording that Alexander, Pope Alexander VII, of sacred memory, had used in the year 1664. And this I found to be a bit of a jibe, a sort of tongue-in-cheek, because Alexander VII was Marc Antonio Zondadari's uncle. So when he said that I use his own words, if the uncle of your previous grandmaster had offended you, then I am offending you. This is my judgment, my implication. It's not written as a footnote in the letters. However, why mention him? I mean, why not mention the previous bulls? Why not clarify, after all? Because he wrote, the Pope wrote it, he could have clarified. He says, no, you are included, or no, you are excluded. This is all Marcello was asking, no? Meanwhile, the prior keeps on asking for a copy of a letter that would exempt him. The prior somehow, don't ask me how, obtains a copy of a letter that this nuncio had sent to the Archbishop of Prague, advising him to raise 50,000 thalers to help the emperor, who was to subsequently send a declaration of the brief in which were mentioned all the privileged, including the Jesuits and the Order of St. John. This was not a letter sent to the prior. He obtained a copy. Again, Sacchetti goes to Sluzio, to Monsignor Sluzio, to repeat, to obtain what he wants. He just repeats the same clause. He says, you are not mentioned by name. That is all I can say, so you are safe. But there is nothing written, and it is open to interpretation. So what does he do now? He writes to the Grand Master about the information that he got, that he had got from the Secretary of State, Cardinal Cibo. He said, I just sent for a copy of the letter from the Secretary of State, and if I have it in time, I will send it to your Eminence, a copy of which you can register. Thing is that here, the dilemma that Sacchetti was facing was quite clear. The dilemma was this, that if the order is not mentioned, if I press on and on, will it do the opposite of my intentions? Will it make them do the opposite of my intentions, that as if they had, thanks for reminding us, you are included? But if I don't mention, what will the nuncio, the Pope's representative in Bohemia, say that the hospital is actually included in those words? Eventually he obtains what he wants. And again, the finance of the order is safe. And the order was safe as long as its finance, its revenue, kept on coming. I am not much of a subscriber to the idea of a decline of the order. As long as the money was pouring in, they spent it quite wisely and continued with their mission. But perhaps on the decline or the lack of it, of the order, I would leave the mic to my friend Alex. That's my conclusion. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Adrian, for an interesting, well, let's say, analysis, even reading between the lines, may I say. Now, before I pass on to our next speaker, Alex Farrugia, I need to read the bio note of Adrian. I apologize to you, but in the rush to start of that's him. That's got to blame. Manuel. Yes, Manuel's to blame. So let me just read the short bio note of regarding Adrian Sherry. He graduated in theology in 1997. And successfully obtained also a master's degree in the same area, that is, in 2006, specializing in the Gospel of St. John. Since the military orders have always been an interest to him, he took the opportunity when an MA in Hospitaller Studies became available for the first time at the University of Malta. He took the order's diplomacy as his area of specialization, concentrating on the career of Fra Marcello Sacchetti, as you well are aware now, ambassador for the order of at the Holy See during the magistracy of Fra Gregorio Carafa. Now, let's pass on to Alex Farrugia. I will now, of course, read the bio note now. as it should have been. Alex Farrugia studied philosophy and history at the University of Malta, recently graduating in hospitalier studies. He is the editor of the weekly newspaper at Torcha and lectures in philosophy. He is also a published author of a number of literary works in Maltese. Alex Farrugia today will be presenting his paper entitled An Order in Decline, An Alternative Perspective on the Order of St. John. Alex.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks also to you who are here. Well, for quite some time, historians of the Order of St. John have been debating about the relevance that the ancient institution retained during the early modern period. The debate has focused particularly on the last century of the order's stay in Malta, before Napoleonic invasion forced it into the major crisis that eventually transformed it into the institution that still survives today. Since in general historians have approached the subject from a somewhat categorical position, they have been quite partisan in their assessment, either by standing for or against the idea that the order kept its relevance way into the 18th century. My purpose here is to propose an alternative view, slightly more complex, tentatively by avoiding having to walk the tightrope of categorization. This remains, however, as you know, a very limited exposition of the argument, merely outlining a proposition that could be further worked upon, refined, and defined. Unlike most historians that have tackled the question, my argument will go beyond the confines of the 18th century. Indeed, my main focus will be on the turn of the century, between the 17th and the 18th, in the object of a series of reports filed by the captains general of the order after their seaborne missions, often called cruises or caravane. Amongst these reports are those of the Genoese general Giovanni Battista Spinola, written by his own hand, collected in the volume AOM 1771 in the archives of the Order of St. John at the National Library in Valletta. It is the last of the four volumes of manuscripts entitled Relazioni dei Venerandi Generali et Comandanti delle Galere et di altri Navigli della Religione, gathering together reports written between 1583 and 1701. In 1700, Giovanni Battista Spinola was Captain General of the Order's galleys. In early spring, he set sail on the usual caravan around the Mediterranean. It was not long before the fleet met a huge Turkish vessel well laden with goods. Ignoring the adverse weather conditions, Spinola gave the order to attack. The end result was devastating. The galley Capitana got sunk during the battle, many men were lost, and Spinola himself had to be saved from drowning. The captain general sought refuge in nearby Zante, then a Venetian dominion, but was met with hostility from a wary proveditor that did not want to be responsible for renewed conflict with the Ottomans by aiding the order's fleet. Full of knightly arrogance, Spinola bullied the proveditor into submitting to his requests. Later the same year, Spinola made up for his previous losses by capturing a sultana, described to the Grand Master by Spinola himself as the most beautiful sultana that sails the sea. The following year, cruising with the fleet close to the Barbary coast, Spinola got word from Maltese seamen that in the Tunisian port of La Galletta were two large vessels berthed under the fort that guarded that Ottoman haven. The captain general was soon heading towards that port, sporting the colors of war. La Galletta was a first-rate port of one of the mightiest Ottoman regencies along the coast of North Africa. It had been attacked before by the galleys of the order, but never had a general thought of taking his fleet right under the firing guns of the fortress overseeing the port and nicking away such a prestigious prey. Spinola's reports are long and verbose, his style flamboyant, reflecting the flamboyancy of the character that wrote them. Arrogant, courageous to the point of recklessness, there was something of the spectacular in the Genoese general. He could easily fit within the splendors of the court in Versailles, where the Sun King Louis XIV reigned. His is the image of an aristocrat of the time. In a culture obsessed with the pursuit of glory, Spinola was one of many desirous of carving a name for himself that would last in eternity. Hungry for fame, the Genoese general believed in the honor obtained by the sword. Spinola was particularly conscious that honorable conduct came also under the form of spectacle, as understood by that notion of glory imported from France during the later 17th century. Such frame of mind explains why, rather than choosing stealth and deception, as had previously often been the strategy employed by the Order on numerous occasions on less daunting targets, he chose to confront the enemy frontally. To quote him, drum beating and other warring manifestation, the sight of which could not be more spectacular and frightening to the enemies. Spinola's versatility with contemporary trends of aristocratic behavior was by no means unique within the order. The reports of the generals are testimony that the Grand Master's court was no backwater of European aristocracy. Generals like Josef Johann, Count of Herbstein, or Sigmund Count Thun not only held important offices within the order but also enjoyed prominence in other European courts. Like Spinola, both generals sought glory through war. The narrative of glory was a late 17th century phenomenon. As the century progressed, the generals' reports present us with a gradual shift in the narrative related to valor and honor. Whilst definitely celebrating military valor and courage during the early 17th century, the knight was presented as a model of selflessness and virtue, risking his life for a greater cause, that of defending religion against the infidel. By the end of the century, the ambitions of the religious warriors were worldlier. The Baroque conception of glory favored heroic fervor and triumphalism. This change in discourse coincided with a period of increasing confidence by the order. Indeed, one can argue that the discourse itself mirrors a sense of consolidated assertiveness that, amongst other things, saw the order sporting the largest galley fleet it ever possessed. Alongside the narrative of glory during the latter half of the 17th century, and the reports written by the generals of the order, started to emerge another narrative, a discourse about sovereignty, a novel interpretation of the order's identity that went beyond the established narrative of a military order by identifying it also as a nation. Mind you, nation as referred here is not meant in the sense of a nation state as evolved from the late 18th century onwards, but rather the newfound bond between a particular territory, its people, and their sovereign that drove the formation of the modern state. As much as armies across Europe were intent on aggrandizing their sovereign and thereby increasing the glory of their country, as from the mid-60s of the 17th century onwards, a new discourse started emerging gradually within the order, similarly inclined towards the aggrandizement of the order itself and the Grand Master as the figure encompassing within his person the state itself. The order adopted the narrative of the nation at the same time that it was spreading on the continent, belying any suggestion that the order fossilized into some kind of inert relic from the past, unresponsive to what was happening in the rest of Europe. In practical terms, this narrative meant that within the order there was a gradual shift in the understanding of its own raison d'etre. One must be clear here, at no point did the order abandon its self-styled vocation as Christianity's own militia. Rather, this newfound sense of finding its own place amongst the nations of Europe set akin to what had been its military-religious mission since the 12th century. The order, therefore, whilst responsive to the changing environment in the political culture of Europe, did not reject its core narrative of a military order of the Church, but rather added a new dimension to it. In his letter to the Provveditore at Zante, haranguing him for giving the cold shoulder to the order's fleet in distress, General Spinola described the disservice done to the order by the Venetian Republic using these words. It seems to me superfluous to suggest to you that doing nothing in such circumstances is an infinite wrong that will offend all of Europe, even more so, going against the needs of a religious republic like ours. It merits a lot of good from the Serene Republic that cannot look towards its conquests without noticing the hands and the blood of those who, only motivated by honor and chivalry, employ themselves in the service of the common cause. It is of particular interest to understand well all the implications that emerge from the general's carefully chosen words. First of all, Spinola asserts that what one might describe as the traditional identity of the Order of St. John as Christianity's own militia. An attentive eye will immediately note that the equation Europe equals Christianity equals civilization was the underlying understanding that Spinola had of Europe, and its defense from barbarity, that is, Islam, was what he claimed to be the common cause. By the time he was writing this, the idea of Christianità as a universalizing concept that went beyond the realm of belief, encompassing a political, geographical, cultural, and military unity identified with Europe, had largely become a discredited fiction, particularly in the great nations of Europe. For the order, however, this idea of Christianità was the foundation stone of its military raison d'être. The very idea of a militia, whose mission was to be of service for the preservation of Christianity, would have found itself redundant had the concept of Christianità ceased to exist. By 1700, to keep alive the idea of Christianità, Spinola could still rely on the memory of numerous Christian leagues formed to rebut Ottoman expansion westwards. In 1686, one such league that saw the participation of Austria, Poland, Lithuania, Venice, and Tuscany alongside the order, had made the significant conquest of Buda from the Ottomans. In fact, Spinola laid his emphasis on conquests rather than defense. Spinola was well aware that a narrative inspired by a Christian ideal for unity and preservation in a Christian republic wary of its powerful Muslim neighbor might strike a chord. For Venice, as well as for other small European maritime cities that did not enjoy the protection of the powerful navies of the north, the concept of Christianità could still have held some practical significance, if anything, to serve as a common platform upon which to form useful alliances to protect themselves from Muslim incursions. Also worth noting is that Spinola described the order as a religious republic, equating the order with a nation in its own right, even if one of a religious stamp, a nation that shed its blood in the service of a cause greater than itself, the preservation and expansion of Europe Christianity. That explains why Spinola hammered in the message that the indifference displayed by the proveditor towards the order's plight will offend all of Europe, whilst the order was a republic, a sovereign nation, it was no ordinary nation. It belonged to all of Europe, and as such, all of Europe had a vested interest in its well-being. Drawing members from all across the European aristocracy, the order was indeed a pan-European organization, and truly at the time, European princes treated it with deference in a multitude of ways, not least by enrolling their sons as members and respecting its sovereignty on the estates that the order held within their territories. Equally revealing is another extract taken from the report that Spinola wrote to the Grand Master the following year, soon after the defeat of La Goletta. He wrote, "I have taken for myself the honor of notifying you, hopefully aggrandizing your eminence and your holy council, because it was followed with special applause from foreign flags that were spectators." Here Spinola linked the glory that followed his unequaled feat with the special applause that foreign flags would give to what they were meant to interpret as the order's unrivaled courage and prowess. As it stands out from the text, Spinola strongly emphasized the causal nexus between foreign acclaim and the aggrandizement of the order. Spinola's choice of words remains revealing of an important reality. Special applause was not simply a symbol of acclaim and recognition of glory. For the order, such special applause was much needed and was a much needed guarantee for the safeguarding of its lifeline with Europe, its continental estates or commendi. The commendi were a feudal creation, reflecting feudal ties of the kind that by the late 17th century were becoming increasingly loose, even though it must be said that in different countries throughout Europe, vestiges of feudal ties remained in existence for almost two centuries later. As European sovereigns were becoming increasingly potent, with the state centralizing power within the hands of an expanding bureaucracy directly answering to its monarch, allowing pockets of territory in the hands of a foreign nation, even if it was, strictly speaking, a privileged order of the church, like the Order of St. John, started raising eyebrows, if not eliciting subdued resistance altogether, especially among that class of state administrators that rose to power from the mercantile middle class that with feudal mentality shared very little. It was in the order's interest, therefore, to show European princes that such concessions yielded return. A claim of the kind that Spinola boasted about when writing back to Valletta meant that the order was still looked upon favorably, guaranteeing the safeguarding of its holdings on the continent. By the end of the 17th century, the order was facing a delicate situation. The Ottoman threat to Western Europe had abated. By the Treaty of Karlowitz in 1699, the Ottoman Sultan was for the first time forced into a treaty that yielded territory to his Christian enemies. as the Turkish Armada withdrew permanently in the Levantine side of the Mediterranean, at the gates of Vienna, its landward expansion was halted and soon would start to be reversed. It was also during the 17th century that France took over from Venice the primacy of Christian power in the Levant. The French settled in Constantinople, forging alliances with the Porte and acting as the interlocutors of Europe with the Ottoman Empire. In the process, they started granting protection to Ottoman merchants and shipping, subtly channeling the carrying market towards an ascending dependency on French shipping. The Order's disruptive presence in the Levant, through acts of piracy conducted by the fleet of the Order and also by privateers flying the Order's flag, became increasingly annoying to French interests, and mounting pressure on successive Grand Masters, combined with further pressures from the papacy, eventually led to the Order abandoning its Levantine Corso. If the Ottoman threat had subsided, it had not died. In the Western Mediterranean, the Ottoman threat was kept alive largely through the constant aggression of the Barbary regencies of North Africa. These regencies were technically Ottoman satellites, and therefore ways of pillaging and looting on Christian soil, particularly of small undefended towns on the northern coastline of the Mediterranean, still held those populations in fear. The threat had become increasingly ineffectual in significant terms to the large European powers that dominated the sea. Both the English and the French eventually forced the Barbary states into a series of treaties and concessions. France, however, had further ambitions. It wanted to protect its merchant shipping based in Marseille from the threat of competition by the Barbary states. Salvatore Bono, in fact, holds that by redirecting the Christian Corso against the merchant shipping from Barbary, Europeans, particularly the French, managed to hold a monopoly in the commerce and transport of Maghrebian products. The Order of St. John was forced to change not just the theater of its perennial war against Islam, but also the rationale behind its warring activities. The general's reports bear testimony to this redirection of the Order's corsairing activities towards the Western Mediterranean, largely occupying itself with the policing of the seas to protect European merchant shipping from the Barbary corsairs. From defenders of Christian civilization, they pretty much ended up as security guards to its commerce. Members of the Order found it very difficult to accept this new role. Indeed, many considered it as degrading and that the institution was not living up to its glorious history. In reality, the Order did not have much room for maneuver. It could not ignore French pressure. France was the Order's most generous patron. The largest proportion of its holdings was, in fact, on French territory. France, therefore, was in a position to dictate. For Professor Victor Malia Milanis, the Order managed to keep its relevance even within the context of such changes. Various sources, of which Malia Milanis makes ample use to sustain his argument, certainly point towards the direction. However, one has to qualify up to which point the Order still held such relevance. Even such a skeptic about the Order's ability to maintain its relevance and adapt to change, as the French historian Michel Fontenay concedes that the Order was still viewed during the 18th century as a valid academy for the sons of the aristocracy. The Order certainly retained its identity as a very exclusive club where members, particularly those destined for the knighthood, had to prove their nobility of blood through careful examination of their aristocratic pedigree. However, it was a different matter altogether when it came to the military relevance of the Order. The armies and navies of European states had grown to such dimensions that rendered the idea of a protective knighthood for Europe an obsolete, almost risible idea. The Order of St. John, however, remained a very useful ally to other small Mediterranean seafaring states in order to form alliances to protect them against incursions from the Barbary corsairs. In a letter dated 26 January 1764, the Grand Master felt confident to write to the receiver of the Order in Venice, Richard Zenobio, to encourage the representatives of a number of European princes to invest in the Order's military machine, so that a project could be launched that would eradicate from the roots this ill-born race of pirates. The Grand Master was writing in response to the idea nurtured by the Court of Naples to call for a grand coalition against the Barbary states. He listed those nations that were currently at war with Barbary: the Papal States, the Grand Duchy of Tuscany, the Austrians, the Kingdom of the Two Sicilies, the Kingdom of Sardinia, and the Republic of Genoa. The Grand Master emphasized the point that since its inception, the order had made its mission to wage war against the infidel and protect Christian commerce. One cannot fail to note once more the discursive shift from the protection of Christian civilization to the protection of its commerce. The transition of operations from Levantine waters to the West had important economical repercussions on the order. The prices yielded by the Corsair against Barbary were much leaner than those brought from the Levant, especially when the target had been the Alexandria-Constantinople commercial route. Submitting to external pressures and confining its operations within the Western Mediterranean, the order had lost considerable incomes. Maria Milanes argues that the Corsair had previously provided the order with an opportunity to raise enough income to make it economically viable independently from the revenues yielded by its European holdings. Such economic autonomy also meant relative political freedom from its European patrons. However, by the end of the 17th century, due to the loss of strong incomes from the Corso, the order was forced to rely again on its landed properties on the continent for its economic subsistence. To borrow Brodelian terminology, the order was forced into a process of refeudalization at a time when feudalism was increasingly becoming out of fashion. Once more, this leads to General Spinola's eagerness for the special applause accorded to the order by foreign flags. The discussion above contextualizes Spinola's frame of mind and shows that in the face of change, the order was caught in what Emanuel Wallerstein would today call a historically uneasy compromise between its striving towards ascendancy among nations and its chronic dependence on the generosity of its patrons to maintain its economic subsistence and lifeline. Whilst its patrons aspired towards greatness through expansion and conquest, the order could only aspire towards greatness if it retained the favor of such patrons and guaranteed its centuries-long privileges. The order's sovereignty and ascendancy, in other words, became increasingly dependent on the perceived usefulness it retained in the eyes of its patrons. By the closing decades of the 17th century, therefore, already emerged what would be the major challenge for the order's existence during the 18th. Circumstance certainly played an important part in the closing of that long chapter of such a historical uneasy compromise in the way it did. However, one must go beyond the forces of circumstance. If circumstance was able to mark so powerfully the institution, it was only because the institution itself had been unable to generate resistance against circumstance. By 1700, it was already evident that the order had different levels of adaptation to change. The order was able to change according to the fashion of the times, when this merely gave a new dimension to discursive practices already well established within the institution. Thus, as shown above, the order was up to date with the latest discursive embellishment adopted by the aristocracy around Europe. On another level, the order adapted to change when it was externally forced upon it by its own patrons, as in the case of France, that pressured the order to redirect its operations at sea westwards. As already shown, the order tried to adapt by reconstructing its self-narrative to suit the circumstances. Thus, whilst retaining the narrative of being Christianity's own militia, the order reconstructed such a narrative to accommodate an economic rather than a holy war. Its mission was recast into the safeguarding of Christian commerce rather than Christian civilization. Underlying all this, however, there was a resilient resistance from the order to modify its core narrative. Till that fateful day when Napoleon's fleet was first seen on the horizon from Valletta, the order never failed to see itself as it had since the 12th century, a product of the Crusades, as a militia set up to defend Christianity against the infidel, as an aristocratic organization bound to serve by the sword a cause greater than itself. As long as change did not challenge that narrative, the order was able to adapt easily. When change brought a challenge that was outside of the core narrative, the new reality set akin to it, as identifying the order itself as a nation set akin to its crusading ideals, however uneasy such a compromise might have been. There was resistance, however, when change directly undermined some part of that core narrative established so long before. Thanks a lot.
Now, thank you very much, Alex. We'll conclude here. Just a reminder, please, tomorrow these sessions will continue between 6 and 8 as per advertised program. And anybody who would like to check on the program can go to www.maltahistory.eu. And there you will find, of course, on the net, you will find the whole program. Thank you very much and good night.
I'd now like to invite Valentina Lupo for her presentation. Valentina Lupo is a fresh graduate in conservation and restoration of paintings and polychrome sculptures. And she will be presenting an overview of her dissertation, which concerns a study of the polychrome wooden statue of St. John the Baptist located at Dingley Parish Church. Valentina?
So the study concerns a life-size medieval wooden statue of St. John the Baptist, which is presumed to be brought to Malta by the Knights of St. John in the 16th century. The statue is probably the only surviving example of freestanding wooden polychrome sculpture in the Maltese Islands. Over the ages, the statue went through a number of undocumented restoration interventions. In the main restoration intervention, the polychromy of the statue was covered with a dark brown coating, which transformed the statue into a monochrome sculpture. The decision to carry out the study was determined by the fact that hardly anything is known about its constituent materials and its manufacturing technique. And furthermore, its intrinsic value of the statue has been highlighted by Professor Mario Buhajar as a work of art historical importance in Maltese cultural heritage. Something about its history. It is thought that it was brought to Malta by the Knights of St. John, as I already said, and the statue may have an association with the Gran Carraca Sant'Anna, possibly being one of the cult statues that adorned the ship's chapel. In 1684, the prior of the conventual church donated the statue together with another carved statue of St. James to the Grotto of St. Paul in Rabat. And a few years later, the statues were transferred to the newly established Parish Church of Dingley. The whereabouts and subsequent history of the statue of St. James is unknown, as it has been missing from Dingley for quite some time. In 1946, Hugh Brown reported that the statue was covered with armorial graffiti. However, today only one shield, a very small shield, is visible, as you can see in the infrared image on the camel's forehead. The shield is said to represent the arms of Grandmaster Lila Dam, and suggesting a connection with the Grandmaster who brought the knights to Malta. Additionally, today there has not been found any detailed description of the statue before the dark brown coating was applied, nor anything about its application. However, it has only been documented that artist and restorer Oscar Testa treated the statue against insect infestation in the 1960s. The statue was suffering severely from an insect infestation, and thus it was treated by means of an insecticide applied by a syringe. The main aims of the study were to understand better the structure of the statue and its polychromy, to shed further light about the statue in the context of the history and materials of the medieval period, to describe additions and alterations which were as a result of both natural and human interventions, and finally, to determine the state of conservation of the statue. The study started with non-invasive investigations, which involved methods which do not invade the materials of the work of art. Preliminary examinations started by close observations of the statues with varied light arrangements, first in normal light, raking light, UV light, infrared radiation, and X-ray radiology. And then, after mapping and graphic documentation of all the observations noted, was carried out. The interior core was also investigated to understand the construction of the statue. This was done by inserting a small pocket camera in the narrow opening on the left-hand side of the statue. Considering that the wooden support of the statue is a crucial factor for its stability, the wood can change its physical and mechanical properties due to absorption and desorption of moisture. Thus, an environmental monitoring campaign was carried out for a period of 7 months to monitor relative humidity and temperature inside the sacristy. From the data obtained, wood moisture content charts were plotted in order to predict the development of Anobium punctatum, which is the commonly known furniture beetle. The non-invasive investigations already discussed were useful to determine which particular area of the statue to sample. Therefore, the invasive investigations followed. These images show three areas of sampling and the respective microphotograph taken underneath the microscope for the cross-section sample. In all, a total of 14 samples were taken. 10 samples were taken to study the stratigraphy of the statue, which included the number and nature of the polychrome layers, the binding media, restoration infills, and the nature of the dark brown coating. The four wooden fragments were taken to study the genus of the wood and any later interventions on the wooden support. The analysis of the cross-section samples were first carried out by observing the sample underneath a binocular microscope. The sample was prepared into a cross-section, and the different layers were then observed under an optical microscope. Finally, the cross-section was analyzed under the scanning electron microscope, as you can see in the last photo, for an elemental analysis. Histochemical tests were then carried out by means of different stains to deduce the nature of the binding media. The invasive investigations for the wood. The four wood samples were prepared into thin sections and were analyzed also underneath the binocular microscope. Then all the anatomical observations of the thin sections were noted and transferred to a Delta Key computer software to help identify the genera of the wood. Now some results. The results from the non-invasive investigations have enabled the description to be made of the construction of the statue. The statue is most probably composed of 8 parts. The main body was carved from the trunk of a walnut tree, which was hollowed from the back into a semi-cylindrical shape. This methodology has been used in various other examples of early and late medieval wooden sculpture, such as the crucifix of San Sepolcro in Italy from the 9th century and the later Saint Roch of Germany. This technique reduced the weight of the sculpture and provided flexibility when changes in temperature and relative humidity occurred. From the anatomical observations of the wood samples, 4 different genera of wood were identified in different areas of the statue. To note, most probably the right hand is a later restoration intervention, as it's of pine wood, and its carving technique and polychromy are different from the other hand. Now some results from the stratigraphic polychromy samples. The preparation layer consists of a thin layer of lead white, which was applied to fill the wooden pores and to provide a smooth surface prior to painting. The flesh tone was modeled in a thin layer of red ochre and red lead, which provided a salmon color to the skin tone. The sheep's fleece consisted of a thin layer of lead white and calcium phosphate, a common pigment which was used in the Middle Ages, which was prepared by the burning of animal bones. Now, something about the tunic. The tunic was gilded with a very, very thin layer of pure gold leaf, and from the samples, from the 2 samples I observed, I can conclude that most probably the tunic was painted with red in a 2-layered structure, which composed of a layer of mercury sulfide vermilion, and a 2nd layer of red lead mixed with red ochre. Therefore, the tunic was most probably decorated, as it was a common procedure during the Middle Ages to decorate robes and painting designs over the gold leaf, or uses graffito techniques such as on the volto of San Sepolcro in Italy. Gold leaf, which was not applied, which was not painted, was also found. This suggests that parts of the statue were left just with gold, especially the middle section where the camel is found. Many of the samples analyzed were found to have a thick layer of gesso composed of calcite over the original polychromy. This was applied during the restoration intervention to infill woodworm holes and repair cracks and open joints on the wooden support. The thick gesso infills most probably concealed the rest of the armorial graffiti, which were seen by Hugh Brown in 1946. The thick brown coating was found to be a mixture of three different types of iron oxides, and no other paint additives were found, such as titanium. Therefore, the coating was most probably applied before the 20th century. And it could be that the coating, these are two hypotheses I made in my study, was either applied to conceal the damages that the wooden support and the polychromy which the statue suffered after the insect infestation, or else to make the statue look like one made out of bronze. To conclude, the scientific examination of the statue provided evidence of the presence of original polychromy. These results will be useful for a subsequent conservation and restoration treatment of the statue. Thus, a cleaning methodology to remove the dark brown coating in the future will be indeed guided by the findings of the paint analysis. The main aim of such a cleaning methodology should be to retain the statue original polychromy. I would like to end this presentation with the following quote. Our best guard against misconceptions and imposing the taste of our time is knowledge about objects. The study of materials and technique, in addition to stylistic and iconographic criteria, gives us a wealth of information that will give future research a broader platform for grouping and dating. Further research will require a continuous dialogue between art historians, conservators, and scientists in the interpretation of these works, so to permit deeper comprehension of the objects. In order to understand them, we must study the work of art as the primary source. Thank you.
Thank you, Valentina. Well, Valentina will be graduating tomorrow, so we share. Good luck. And hope that you will continue furthering your studies on such an interesting subject. I'd like to thank you all for being here. Thank you and good evening.
You have just listened to a talk organized by the Malta Historical Society. This talk was delivered by Adrian Sherry as part of the Malta Historical Society Week. The second talk was delivered by Valentina Lupo.